Good afternoon. We're delighted to welcome you all, but especially delighted to welcome the Pre-Law Society. Would the members of the Pre-Law Society stand, please? And is that with the University of Wisconsin-Madison? Good. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Do you have information about this case that we're about to hear? Do you have a summary of the case? Would you like a summary? Does anyone want a summary? You have a summary. Okay. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice Patience Rogan-Sack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. And to her right is Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I'll call our last case for today and the February argument, 06-AP-939, Estate of James B. Sustesh versus American Family Mutual Insurance Company. Arguing on behalf of Matthews is John V. O'Connor. Mr. O'Connor?
May it please the court. The Four Corners Rule is a bright line test. It's easy to apply, and in instances such as this, if it's applied with no exceptions, it's unfair and unjust. I cannot, nor could the Court of Appeals, reconcile the various decisions that were made by the appellate courts over the last 40 years. They are inconsistent, and I can't begin to reconcile them. The Court of Appeals suggested that if it had the right to make policy decisions, it might have come to a different conclusion. But it determined that the Four Corners Rule gets applied without exception based on recent case law, and that earlier case law had been overturned sub silentio. I believe that the reason that there is confusion is because of the direct action statute. In states where there is no direct action, such as Illinois, there would be two different lawsuits. There would be a lawsuit by the injured party versus the defendant, and there would be a lawsuit by the insured versus the insurance company. We have a direct action statute, and we mix these two lawsuits into one, and the courts have compared apples to oranges and come out with conclusions that are inconsistent and unfair.
So, not that they're inconsistent and unfair, but I think that your comment regarding us having a direct action statute changing the analysis is intriguing. So tell me how it changes the analysis.
Well, I look at a 96 case that you had. It was also a wrongful death case, Fire Insurance Company versus Branston, a 1996 case. In that case, the plaintiff sued the defendant in a separate action and did not sue the insurance company. The insured tendered it to the insurance company, and they started a declaratory judgment action. In that declaratory judgment action, the court said that's an appropriate procedure, but you have to bring the plaintiff in because they have an interest in the outcome of the case. In that situation, when you have a tort claim between one person and another, and you have a contract claim between one person and another, the tort claimant should not be able to control the insurance policy, should not be able to void that insurance policy. That is, when you apply the Four Corners Rule, that declaratory judgment never happens. It goes away. If this case were to go back down to the court and there is a trial, whether there's coverage or not, if you say there is no coverage and we win, and they say that we exercise self-defense in that win, we have won a case, but the insurance company says it's res judicata. Even though it was self-defense, and even though that's res judicata, you can't come back for coverage now. And so if you apply it without exception, if there's no hearing, If there is no determination of the true facts, you protect the insured or the injured party. He always has his day in court, and that's why you did that in the fire insurance case, to ensure the fact that, that the injured party had a say. Following the Elliott rules, you say to the insurance company that the complaint triggers the duty to defend. They got to file an answer. That is the reason that rule is to protect the insured. That is the policy behind the rule, is to protect the insured. But you went in Elliott and said, now wait a minute, those aren't the true facts. We've got to stay that proceeding and let the insurance company establish what the true facts are, and then they don't have to pay the cost of defense when they prove it was an intentional act or it was not a covered peril. The assumption that everyone makes is that the insured or that the injured party wants coverage. That's a false assumption. My client was not charged with a felony. He didn't spend a day in prison. If it was my beautiful son who had died, I wouldn't want the person who had done it to have insurance, because I would want revenge and I would want to garnish his wages until the day he died. And so I would plead an intentional act. If a person has much more money than they have insurance, my motive would be to allege an intentional act so I can get to punitive damages. I don't want the insurance.
Mr. O'Connor, let me interrupt you for a minute.
Please.
Do we have to resolve the four corners rule in this case? Isn't there also an issue in regard to whether or not there's an occurrence under the policy? And isn't that an issue that could be resolved without ever getting to the four corners rule?
That would be horrible tragedy, but it is possible that both issues are before the court. Do you prefer that I address that now?
Let's spend some time with it, okay?
Sure. It would be helpful.
With regard to every tort claim, where there is a defense which is privilege, where you raise the defense of privilege, it is never going to come up in the complaint that there is sovereign immunity or that there's the equine privilege or the privilege for recreational use or the privilege with regard to using reasonable force. There's a person who is choking my child. My child is turning blue. He's on the ground. I come up and I knee him in the head in order to save my child. I have caused them injury. And even though I have caused them injury, if I caused them injury and it was privileged, I take the position that there is coverage. If I cause injury to a person and that injury is either negligent or that injury is caused through privilege, there is coverage in my belief.
Well, now the policy, this is a follow-up to Justice Crooks. The policy excludes coverage for bodily injury caused intentionally by any insured, right?
Yes.
So did...
As an example, there is a crowd of people who are...
Just use this case. This is a case, a good example. Yep. Did he cause intentionally... Was bodily injury caused intentionally by the insured?
Your Honor, my client was surrounded by a drunken crowd that were threatening him and taunting him. He tried to fight his way out. If he blocked a punch and dislocated the fellow's shoulder or blocked a kick and broke his ankle, the intention of the insured was not to cause damage to the other person, and certainly not this horrible damage that did in fact occur. His motive was to defend himself, and that is not clearly excluded in the policy, and the courts have given American Family plenty of time to change that and exclude this kind of...
Do you have a case that says that you can intentionally harm another
And it's covered under a policy that excludes intentional acts?
Sure. We, you know, we defend police officers all the time.
Well, tell me a case. I
don't have a case off the top of my...
I'm troubled by the occurrence question, as is Justice Crooks. And though I fully agree with you that your client may have had to defend himself, the testimony I read from him, and I haven't read the whole record, but parts of it, was that they asked him, did you intend to hit him in the jaw? And he said, yes, I did. So when he says that, I don't understand how you get around this policy, which simply excludes coverage for intentional acts. There's nothing in the policy that says if the acts are privileged, then they become an occurrence.
My intention is to do harm to someone else.
Not intentional acts.
Pardon?
Not intentional acts. The policy is
acts.
Policy,
the policy
is
injury.
Injury. If the act, bodily injury caused intentionally by any insured. So intentionally, you think, refers to injury, not the hitting. Is that it?
It's not the hitting.
Injury.
It's the injury. I intend to drive my car. I didn't intend to run that person over. I intended to step on the gas. I intended to make the turn. I did not intend the injury. And so it's looked at, you either look at it from the standpoint of the insured, who is the person who has contracted in this particular policy, and the insured has come to the conclusion that what I am doing is righteous.
Mr. O'Connor, if I could, I want to make sure that we're all on the same page up here and we're not going down two different tracks. Some of the questions have dealt with the intent to injure issue. Some of the questions from Justice Rogensack and from Justice Crooks have dealt with the occurrence issue. Am I incorrect in stating that I see those as two separate things? One involves coverage, the other involves an exclusion?
Yes.
And the intent to injure operates under the exclusion portion of the policy, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And the occurrence is under the coverage portion, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. I just want to make sure I understand exactly where we're going. So are you focusing right now on the exclusion, or are you focusing on the coverage?
If the exclusion was not there, there would clearly be coverage. There
okay,
would be
but
no
what
question.
About the definition of occurrence? Isn't occurrence defined here as an accident?
Right.
Well, the result is accidental. If I swung and missed, there'd be no damage. But if this is not an occurrence, then the number of things that would not be an occurrence, the list goes on and on. Anytime there is a privilege, the privilege allows someone to do an intentional act and have it not be a wrongful act.
Counsel, if I assume that it's an occurrence and then we look at the intentional injury exclusion, how do you reconcile your argument with the fact that the language in the exclusion talks about not covering bodily injury caused intentionally by or at the direction, even if that injury is different than that which was expected or intended?
I follow the same reasoning that the Court of Appeals did in a similar decision, looking at exactly the same language for State Farm. And I believe that they had the same reasoning, is that if an insured does something that causes injury to a person and it is not a wrongful act, then they have a right to believe that they are covered for it unless it is clearly excluded. And the court previously had determined that it was ambiguous and that a person who was exercising self-defense could expect to have coverage under their policy.
You mean Berg? Berg is when the court was talking about?
Yes.
Okay, but that was different policy language, and that was where the court determined the language to be ambiguous.
I think that the language in the American Family policy, and Berg gave them clear direction, is that all you've got to do is clean up your language and clearly exclude privileged acts. And if they did that, then looking at it from the standpoint of the insured, they couldn't expect that there would be coverage. But this is a privileged, rightful act that has occurred. And under those circumstances, police officers and other people who intentionally use force on a person would have coverage unless they had excessive force. And if they had excessive force, certainly there shouldn't be insurance coverage, and they would not be entitled to a defense. But just because the victim claims that it's excessive force, the police officer should not have it forfeited. The complaint should not void the insurance contract. There should be a hearing, a declaratory judgment, and a procedure to protect the rights of the insured, just like the Elliott procedure protects the rights of the insurance company.
Well, how do you answer the argument that the punch was a volitional act? Volitional act under Everson versus Lorenz is not an accident.
Well, I think it depends on the circumstances. If, say, the crowd jumped on him, and they're kicking him and punching him and doing those kinds of things, and he's fighting his way out, from his standpoint, it's not because he wants to punch those people. He is fighting his way out, and in fighting his way out, he is exercising self-defense.
I agree with you, or at least for purposes of our discussion at the moment, I would agree with you that they don't cover bodily injury if it's intentional. So I would agree with you that under the self-defense theory, let us say, there was no intent to harm. It was just an intent to get away. Let's just say those are the facts that can be proven. So I would agree with you that you are not excluded under the intentional injury. Let's just say that. But I have a much harder time under occurrence, because occurrence means accident, and no matter how you portray his conduct, he is deliberately and intentionally striking other people. So how can you get that under accident, under the occurrence? Well, how do you get it out of being an occurrence?
Your Honor, because it is privileged. Because when it is privileged, the court says that doing this is not a wrongful act.
Well, I agree with you. So he's not going to have any liability. You don't care about that for the moment. You just don't want to have to pay his lawyer fees.
Well, I do believe that the duty to defend is distinctly different than the duty to indemnify.
I understand that. And we're talking about duty to defend.
And I think that, as was decided in Berg, that if you want to exclude privileged acts that are not wrongful, that we're looking at it from the standpoint of the insured and what the insured's expectation is. And if I hurt someone in a way that is privileged, that I expect that my insurance company will be there for me.
But if I can follow up the Chief's question, Mr. O'Connor, you said doesn't exclude. And I think the Chief's question, as I understand it, on occurrence, is a different one. It's whether or not, if there's a volitional act, the policy covers that volitional act. It's whether or not it's defined under the policy as an occurrence. And what I'm trying to understand is how privilege deals with the occurrence language of the policy, not the exclusion, but with the occurrence, whether or not this operates as an occurrence under the policy.
The effect is accidental, because the intent is not to cause that effect. And that is what the accident is. The accident is that I'm intending to do this. I am not intending that effect. That is not what motivates my actions. And that is why it is an accident. Just as if someone intentionally discharges a gun thinking that there's a bear behind the bushes and shoots his shooting partner. He certainly intended to aim and pull the trigger and shoot what was behind those bushes. He did not intend to shoot his hunting partner. It's an intentional act, but it's an accident because he did not intend that result. That was not his motivation. That isn't what caused him to do it. He may have killed his hunting partner, but he should have coverage for that because even though he aimed and discharged his weapon, he did not intend the result. And the result is what determines whether or not it was an accident. You have to go to his subjective state of mind, and if that is not the result that he intended, then it is an accident.
Counsel, I want the very thing you're talking about. I look at two cases, Doyle, and I look at Everson. Then I also look at the definition of occurrence. This is, correct me if I am in error. I think both in Doyle and in Everson, both courts defined accident. And that's of moment here. That's important here because under this contract, under this policy of insurance, occurrence means an accident, right? So we got to focus on what does accident mean. Now, in Doyle, the court said that an accident is an unforeseen incident. That's the harm or the injury, which is characterized by a lack of intention. I would say that's unintentional. Unintentional injury. If you define accident as you did in Doyle, then I think you have that's simpatico, that's consistent with your argument. If you define accident as the court did in Everson, I think you have more of an uphill battle. So what's different about those cases? Which definition should we use of accident?
Your Honor, I would suggest that you not look at definitions.
Okay.
As the court often does, is this an insured peril? Can a person who purchased this policy, when the bet was made between the insured and the insurance company, what was their intention? Did they intend to cover this risk?
Expectation of insured, you're talking about?
The expectation
framework?
Of the insured and the insurer. I'm covering the accidental injuries that you cause, and that is what the insurance policy is all about. And if you look at it from a risk standpoint, instead of a semantic standpoint, this is the expectation of both the insurance company and the insured that incidents like this would be covered by this policy. And that is a much more reasonable and rational way of analyzing this case rather than analyzing the language of the policy. And we think that that would be a better way to approach it rather than stretching changing definitions in insurance policies. And I realize that for the industry they'd like it, one size fits all. But I think that analyzing, as the court often does, from the standpoint of was this something that someone could expect to get insurance coverage? When an architect is charged with conspiracy, and the court looked at it from that standpoint, is that when the taxpayers are suing you because you were involved in a conspiracy, errors and omissions policies aren't intending to cover that. That risk is outside the scope of the policy, and you don't have coverage, Mr. Architect. And that is a way that the court didn't analyze it. Was this occurrence? Was this, didn't go to the policy language. They look at the policy as a whole and say, what was it intended to do by both sides? And it wasn't intended to protect that architect from a bunch of crazy taxpayers who were suing them for a conspiracy. And so that approach is an approach that this court can and, I believe, should take in this case. No matter what the language says, whether you should say, I want to, read it broadly and in favor of the insured, as the court has done so many times in the past, or I'm going to read it narrowly and have it say just what it says, I think that it has to be interpreted with having what was the intention of the parties.
Well, how do you explain Everson? That was the case where there was a typographical error. It was a misrepresentation.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what did the court say? Was that an occurrence? Where the occurrence was defined as accident? They said, no, it's a volitional act.
Your Honor, I'm drawing a blank on the case.
Oh, okay. If I remember this, the policy would cover occurrences, meaning accident, including continuous exposure. And the court defined accident as an unintended and unforeseen injurious occurrence, something that does not occur in the usual course of events or couldn't be reasonably anticipated. Accident means an unexpected, undesirable event or an unforeseen incident which is characterized by a lack of intention. Do you accept any of those definitions?
Yes.
All of them or some of them?
I
don't find them consistent, by the way. I think they're inconsistent.
Well, I think that when you look at it from the point of view of the actor, that the actor, the defendant, didn't want or expect or try and get that result. That if it was a mistake, even though it was intentional, there's coverage. If it is fraud, there is no coverage. And I think that it has to be analyzed from the point of view of the insured and whether or not it was something that both the insurance company and the insured could reasonably expect to be covered. Certainly, it's a contract between the parties, and the insurance company could have made the language stronger and clearer, as suggested in Berg, and could have had the result that it come out in a way that would be there would be no question. But there is question here. I don't find the language to be any stronger here in this contract than it was in Berg. And if the Court of Appeals can give a contract that kind of interpretation, then an insured should be able to come to the same conclusion.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Harry J. Booth, attorney for American Family.
May it please the court. My name is Terry Booth. I represent American Family Mutual Insurance Company. This case has been postured as one that deals with the Four Corners Rule. It really isn't. The Four Corners Rule is the rule that controls the initial determination of whether or not there's a duty to defend. This case is beyond that point, and there is a different rule that controls this situation. American Family did satisfy its initial Four Corners Rule obligations. It provided a defense. It's continuing to provide a defense to the Matthews. But this case is beyond that. American Family moved for summary judgment. the trial court made a determination not only with regard to a duty to defend, but also with regard to the duty to indemnify. The court's ruling and the court's order indicates that there is no coverage. In other words, there isn't a duty to indemnify. And from that flowed the lack of an obligation to defend. The rule that is applicable in this situation is that there is no duty to defend if there is no duty to indemnify. And on that basis, the Court of Appeals decision should be affirmed.
Because the duty to defend was broader than the duty to indemnify.
That's true, Your Honor. And that is the statement that combines, or it explains the relationship between two different rules. We have a four corners rule, and we have the rule that there's no duty to defend if there's no duty to indemnify. And the rule that the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify shows the relationship between those two. At the outset of a case, you look at the four corners of the pleading. You see if there is any obligation whatsoever under any construction of those pleadings, if there is an obligation to defend. That's the four corners. That is an obligation that is broader than the duty to indemnify. And that is the obligation that the insurer must satisfy at the outset of the case. Then we begin on the process that was described by Mr. O'Connor, that is described in Elliott and in the other cases, that you provide a defense initially, then you, if the insurer isn't involved, you move to intervene, you move to stay, you move to bifurcate, and you resolve the insurance coverage issue first, whether there is a duty to indemnify. That's the process. You start where the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify, and then you get to the point of determining whether or not there is a duty to indemnify. And that's done through summary judgment. If summary judgment is not appropriate because there's some factual issue, you have a trial on that issue. That's why you bifurcate it. But you make a determination that there is or is not a duty to indemnify.
Counsel, I want to give you a hypothetical. And then I want you to tell me whether there is an occurrence under your policy, and therefore coverage, and I want you to address whether or not it's excluded under your policy under intentional injury, which I see the two policy provisions that that you want to focus on and did focus on in your brief. Here I am, third grade. I'm playing with my best friend, Terry Connors. We're over at my house, and we're wrestling. And we're going to see, we have short matches, 2 minutes each, but our alarm clock goes off, and we'll see who wins. And so we're playing on the top bunk, and Terry's won a couple, I've won a couple, and I think I'm going to get him, and I can see him right here on the top bunk, and I take up my leg, and I push him. Goes off the top bunk, lands on the floor, starts crying. Here's my best friend, and he's crying, he's shrieking. I get off the top bunk, I say, Terry, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hurt you, and he's crying. Well, indeed, Terry fractured his shoulder. Now, let's say there's a homeowner's policy just like yours. Is there an occurrence under those facts where I sure intended to push him off because I wanted to win the next two-minute match? But God knows, he's my best friend. I didn't want him to break his shoulder, fracture his shoulder. So tell me, is there an occurrence under your homeowner's policy?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
The reason being,
I want you to look at the language, and I want you to walk me through the language of the policy on this.
Which language?
Occurrence.
Occurrence.
Occurrence means an accident. Why wasn't Terry's injury an accident?
The reason that it is not an accident, Your Honor, is basically the reasoning that is found in the Everson case.
Okay, we're going to go through Everson and we're going to go through Doyle. So tell me, you're relying on Everson, and you would define, even though I said, oh, Terry, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hurt you. How do you define occurrence means an accident? How are you defining accident under this policy?
Your Honor, I think the focus is different in the two different possibilities. One is, are you focusing on the end result, or are you focusing on the act, the event, the occurrence? The occurrence, the event, the act, the thing that is operative is the push, the shove. It is the deliberate and intentional act.
That wasn't the focus in Doyle, however. So why should your definition follow Everson rather than Doyle? In Doyle, accident was defined as an unforeseen incident, that is, the harm or injury that's characterized by a lack of intention, not an intention to injure. Why not that definition?
As I recall, Your Honor, I believe that Everson cited to Doyle in coming to its result. There was a definite, the court in Everson, I believe, cited, and I may be wrong, but there was a citation to a definition that I believe came from Doyle. That was the starting point, and the court talked about how an accident.
Okay. You're right, and that's on page 20, distinguishing the facts. I'm not sure what this case, if it falls more into the Doyle line or the Everson on the facts. I'm just not sure. But let me just take you a step further. So then my mom goes over to Terry's house and explains to Terry's mom, Phyllis. And she said, Phyllis, there was an accident, and Terry's hurt. Don't you think that's the way my mom would describe it? Not thinking about liability at all. I mean, talking about just the vernacular. Oh, my God, there's been a horrible accident. Terry's crying and his shoulder's injured. So why shouldn't we take a layperson's interpretation of accident and you meld it into the reasonable expectation of the insured, have an occurrence there? Maybe you shouldn't, but give me the argument. I'm not saying you should. I do want the argument.
Yeah. Your Honor, I think we're dealing with, are we going to focus on the actual injury that was incurred, or are we going to focus on the event, the action, the operative event? I think Everson tells us we look at the operative event, the push, the shove. I agree with you that, you know, a lot of people...
Doyle says it differently. So what's the difference? How do we define it then? The Everson way or the Doyle way?
I think that Everson has expanded upon and refined the fine decision in Doyle. But I think that when you look at Everson and you look at the cases that are cited in Everson, and then you look at the cases that are cited in the cases that are cited in Everson, there are a lot of cases out there that have all kinds of factual circumstances. And they deal with this very issue. What do you focus on? What is the event that you focus on? And I know that in Everson there was some difference of opinion as to what you focus on, what is the event you focus on. I think you look at Everson and the result in Everson, you look at the cases that were cited in Everson and the cases upon which those cases were decided, and I think you get a clear picture of not only what this court has done, but also of what courts from around the country have done, and that is to make the focus, in your example, Your Honor, the push. It is the push. It is not the motivation of the push that is relevant. And I think we cited in our brief a couple of the background cases that deal with this antecedent mistake. Is there an antecedent mistake about what's going on? Is there an antecedent mistake about what the result of this is going to be?
I find this interesting. I mean, which one do you focus on? And I find it very interesting. you could set that aside and just say, what would a reasonable insured intend? I'm not saying that you should in this case, but that's a different analytical framework.
I'm sorry, I missed your point, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, because obviously I wasn't clear. I think my mom, in saying it was an accident, would see the description of the event which I gave as just that, it was an accident, and didn't mean at all to hurt Terry. They're best friends. So that's kind of the vernacular, under those facts, the reasonable expectation of the insured in terms of definition and coverage. Would my mom think, if we had enough money to have a homeowner's insurance, that if it was an accident, it would be covered? She'd look at that and say, means an accident, must be covered, because that's what it was. That's one way of approaching it. Another way of approaching it is, do we focus on the event? Is the precipitating event volitional? I mean, just what you're talking about. And so I think we have to make us a... And you could then, as I say, do the Everson approach or the Doyle approach, and you can decide. But I think, first of all, we have to decide which one is the appropriate frame of analysis, because sometimes you can come to different conclusions depending on the framework of analysis.
And I think the framework of analysis is Everson, Your Honor. Everson is the later case. Everson is the refinement. Everson uses Doyle as part of its discussion. Everson is based on a lot of other cases. And I would note also that that your example is an interesting one in that it's quite a bit different from what we have here. We have a kid who, on December 31st, outside at night, takes his shirt off to get ready for a fight. He's in front of another kid, and they're going at it and you know, making various statements to each other. And he takes his fist, and he intends to hit him in the face, and he hits him in the face. That is a clearly volitional, intentional act intended to cause some harm.
That falls into your opposing counsel's argument, though. That's kind of a, you know, what would the reasonable insured expect? You know, I'm not sure the difference, I don't know this, should the difference in facts change what the definition is for occurrence?
No, it shouldn't change the definition at all. But, Your Honor, as I started out with, what we're dealing with here is we're not dealing with an initial four-corner situation. We're dealing with a situation that has gone beyond that point. And in the situation that you have suggested, that might be a case that would be closer. Maybe that is something that is negligent as opposed to intentional. Maybe that is something different. And in that kind of a situation, once you do the four corners test and you say, there might be something there, there might be something that would be covered, then you would provide a defense, you would bifurcate and stay, and you would deal with whether or not that is in fact an intentional act, whether it's an occurrence, and you resolve that either by summary judgment or through a trial to deal with the factual issues that you have, and then from that flows the duty to defend or the duty not to defend. In this case, we are at that point, and there has been a determination that there is no duty to indemnify. And in fact, at the trial court level, the duty to indemnify was effectively conceded, and it's been effectively conceded all the way up. In the Court of Appeals decision, the Court of Appeals effectively said, we're dealing with a situation here where there's the question is, can self-defense effectively create a duty to defend when there isn't a duty to indemnify?
Mr. Booth, if I could, because I'm concerned about where we're going with this case and exactly how your argument, how far it goes, in large part in response to Justice Bradley's question. So I want to alter the facts a little bit different, but kind of get them in the framework of this case. All right. Now, as I understand the facts of this case, you have a young man, he's surrounded, he's in fear, he throws the first punch. Let's change it slightly. You have a young man, he's out there, he's surrounded, people start pummeling him, he starts going up to defend himself in this fashion. And in the process of going up to defend himself, he strikes somebody. All right, so he's not intentionally trying to throw a blow. He's going up and trying to block, but he strikes somebody. Under the policy, is that an occurrence?
Your Honor, it's probably a factual question. I don't know.
He intended to raise his arm. Is that part of your facts? No.
He's raising his arms. And the question is, is that volitional under the policy? And the reason I'm pressing you on that is because, as I understand the complaint and how it's worded, I set it off to the side. My understanding of the amended complaint is that it alleges a battery.
There was a battery alleged. There was also negligence alleged. So that created it.
Yeah. That's the one I'm looking for, the Second Amendment complaint. And the reason I ask the question is because where would one, in a complaint that alleges a battery, and under those fact situation, under that particular fact situation, how does one, in trying to ascertain whether or not the insurance company has a duty to defend them, get before the court the facts of the pure defensive actions as opposed to the volitional throwing the punch? You understand my question? And maybe your answer is we're already beyond there because we're past the four corners, because we're at the indemnification. That might be your answer, but you understand the gist of my question.
And Your Honor, you're exactly right. I think we're beyond that point, but I had intended to deal with exactly that question anyways, because I think it's important. I think what the Court of Appeals did in that regard is exactly correct, and we'd ask this Court to affirm that same kind of determination with regard to the Four Corners Rule and its application. In the case where there is only an allegation of a battery, that is something that there would not be coverage for, there would not be a duty to defend. The fact that there would be a potential for facts that would indicate that there was self-defense involved doesn't change the coverage analysis. So the true facts exception that is being suggested here that this Court should adopt doesn't apply in this case because under the true facts, in other words, self-defense, there's no liability either. So under either the facts of a battery or the facts of self-defense, there is no liability. And we need to look to the contract itself, the insurance policy. The insurance policy is the thing that defines what the duty to defend is. The insurance policy, in its defense provision, indicates that it provides coverage for matters that are covered under the policy. So you go from that point and you determine what is covered under the policy. You look at the insuring clause. And there are really two parts to that insuring clause. The first part indicates that it covers matters, damages for which an insured is legally liable. That's the first part. Because of bodily injury or property damage caused by an occurrence covered by this policy. So covered by this policy is one of the things, legally liable is the other. When you look at your situation, Your Honor, the self-defense situation is something for which there is no legal liability. Self-defense...
There's an occurrence. You forgot that.
Pardon?
Legally liable if it's occurrence and not excluded. That is covered by the policy. So that's what... three things you're dealing with, right? So you need, we'll pay those sums for which we are legally liable because there's an occurrence and it's covered by the policy. Covered by the policy means, in part, not excluded by the policy.
Yes.
Okay, so occurrence and exclusion is what you're focusing on, really.
Mm-hmm. Yes, although, Your Honor, as Justice Butler mentioned, I think we're beyond that point. I think there's been a determination that there is no indemnification here. We have a situation where if this is, first of all, there was the negligence allegation. Nobody in this case has ever said that negligence allegation is viable. And we have the Smith versus Keller case, that Court of Appeals case, that says that if you take your fist and you hit somebody in the face with it, that is something that is just so likely to...
But that's why I pressed you on the question, because in the scenario that I gave you, that's not what occurred. And I understand that's different from this case. And the scenario I gave you, it's purely a defensive reaction to being attacked. And under that situation, it would seem to me, unless I'm misreading the policy, that would constitute an occurrence under the policy. And if it was an occurrence under the policy, then you have the issue of whether or not there's intent to injure, as I understand the policy language, and as we've interpreted in this area. And if that is, it would seem to me then you may have an issue of coverage, and when in doubt, we generally hold in favor of coverage. So my question, and that's why I'm trying to push you on it, just where we draw the line, because it would seem to me under that fact situation that maybe we should be looking at Berg. Maybe we should be, now I'm talking about the situation I provided, not specific, but maybe we should be looking at Berg. Maybe we should be looking at Grebe. Because how else is the court going to know? And how else are you going to make determinations as to whether or not there is coverage and there is liability?
Your Honor, the answer is that the complaint is the thing that sets the stage for what's being alleged. There is an allegation of a battery. The defense of self-defense is a subset of battery. It takes something away from the whole scope of the potential liability. An insurance policy covers claims and liabilities. Battery is the claim and liability that is alleged. If you take self-defense actually takes something away from that. It is a lesser situation. Self-defense doesn't create additional liability. That effectively is what Berg is saying, is that if you allege self-defense, or if self-defense are the true facts, that you're creating some additional liability for which there may be coverage that didn't exist under just a battery claim. But that's not right. Battery is the broader claim. So if there isn't coverage for battery, then there's not going to be coverage for a lesser situation that is something less than battery. And I want as an additional follow-up to that whole idea, get into the area of the reasonable expectations of the insured and the suggestion that, well, this just doesn't seem fair, that if you didn't do anything wrong, why shouldn't you get a defense? The problem with that is that that's not what the policy provides. The policy provides that you get a defense if you have a covered situation. And in the situation that we have here, we have an allegation of self-defense, and the argument is, well, the person is innocent. He really didn't do anything wrong, and why should he be penalized? Why shouldn't he get a defense under those circumstances? I want to take that one step further, and I think that illustrates how that argument is problematic and it just can't be adopted by this court. Let's look at the situation where you have an allegation of battery, but the person who was alleged to have battered the person was on the other side of the room, wasn't involved at all, is completely innocent, is totally wrongfully accused. We have a situation where that person is certainly less culpable than somebody who was standing right in front of somebody and may have hit somebody in self-defense or may have battered the person. But in that situation, when we have just a battery and the person who's in another room somewhere else, I don't think that anyone would argue that that person is entitled to a defense because that gets us into the situation where anyone is entitled to a defense under any circumstance, regardless of what the allegation is. And I know this is going to be...
May I just interrupt you? Should we just affirm the Court of Appeals decision without comment because it's so good and it has no errors? Is that what you want us to do?
That would be fine.
You win. I know you win. And of course, that's your objective. I know that you win. That's your objective. But I hear some... I'll ask you this in a different way then. Does the Court of Appeals decision, does it stand for the proposition that the Four Corners rule is the rule in the state of Wisconsin and that Berg is dead?
Yes, that's the way I understand it, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals also, though, is not foreclosing any exceptions that this court may determine.
It's either dead or it's half alive. What is it? Wisconsin Insurance Alliance brief, if I read it, says this court should expressly overrule Berg, clarifying that the Four Corners rule without an exception requiring insurers to engage in an investigation of facts external to the complaint remains the law in Wisconsin. That's why I asked you this question, because I hear sometimes you're saying Berg is gone, Four Corners, and then every once in a while you soften up and say, well, maybe sometimes the Berg rule is alive and well in some corner, but not the Four Corners.
Yeah, Your Honor, if you've gotten that impression, that's not what my position is. Berg, I think, was wrongly decided. It was incorrectly decided. It was decided on language that is different from the American family language in this case. It was based on this expected and intended language, which has created, I think, interpretation problems in American family.
So is it right for that language then? Does it live only for that kind of insurance policy?
Your Honor, I don't think that it was right even for that language. The analysis of the court there in dealing with the expected and intended language, I think was interesting because it dealt with it. The court recognized that that was potentially ambiguous because of that language. And that's what other courts have determined, that there is some ambiguity created by that, because then you get into the intentions of the parties. And that's an area that's difficult. I think the problem with Berg goes back to what is covered and what is not covered. And I don't recall that Berg recited the insuring clause. And that's what we go back to here. What is covered by the insuring clause? And in Berg, in the last footnote, the court noted that under no circumstances is there going to be a duty to indemnify. Footnote 3 at the end of the case. And I think that if you take that end result, and then you go back to the insuring clause and the defense clause, you then apply the principle that there's no duty to defend if there's no duty to indemnify. So I think that Berg was incorrect in that respect. Its ultimate decision was incorrect. I think some of its reasoning, at least with regard to the expected or intended language, was appropriate, that potentially was ambiguous. And I think that it's important to note that Mr. O'Connor has mentioned that, well, Berg said, insurers, you can clarify this in your insurance policies. I think American Family has done that. This expected or intended language appears in various policies, and it has for years, both in the definitions of occurrence, and also in the intentional injury exclusions. And it's created problems in those instances. And Berg said that's the thing that was problematic, that coverage was dependent upon something being expected or intended. American Family has dealt with that. The expected or intended language is not part of its definition of occurrence, as it is in some cases in other jurisdictions and some other times. It is not a part of the intentional injury exclusion in the same way that it was in Berg. In fact, it's in the intentional injury exclusion in the American Family policy in the opposite way. It creates the opposite result. It effectively says, and the form that it appears in was published in 94. Berg was some years before that. It expressly says that regardless of what you intend or expect, this is excluded.
Okay, Mr. Booth, your time has been long up, so I appreciate that. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Connor, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. When American Family is notified of this claim, what is their obligation? Their obligation is to investigate it, to fairly evaluate it, and then do the right thing. They hired Attorney Pike, who went through that, and he filed an answer that says this was self-defense, this was privileged. That is what they put in their pleadings. And so we have to take that, and unless they were filing false pleadings or didn't have a factual background for it, American Family has admitted it is self-defense. Now, whether or not it is self-defense, there has been no finding of fact. The characterization that counsel gives you is not the characterization that I gave you. And there has never been a hearing. There has been no finding of fact by a judge or jury as to whether it was battery or self-defense. It's not there.
Counselor, but you wouldn't get to that until you had a trial that was based on liability, not coverage.
If I had a declaratory judgment action, there would be information that was collected. If there was a question of fact, there would be a trial. And the plaintiff and the defendant would be in it, the insured would be in it, and the question of fact to determine whether or not there was coverage, there would be a trial. Was he defending himself? There would be a trial. There's no question about it. And that's what makes this unfair, unconstitutional, is that we never get that trial. We never get to prove that point. Justice Bradley, another defense that could have been raised and would have been raised by your family when they got sued is that your playmate consented to that. Now the question becomes, when you went to push him off, did you commit a battery? He consented to the wrestling. You did not intend that he be injured. If it is a battery, there's no coverage. If it's an accident because you did not intend to harm your friend, there is coverage and they have a duty to defend.
Mr. O'Connor, if I can press you on that. I understand that argument as it relates to the intentional exclusions portion of the policy. And the reason why I keep pressing both of you on this occurrence is I think there's two tracks going on here, and I think they often get kind of combined. But there's the track that involves the occurrence language of the policy. And with the occurrence language and whether or not there's coverage in the first instance, I don't know if you ever get to the exclusion if there's no coverage in the first instance. So that's why I focus on the occurrence language and whether or not, as an accident, if you have, and I'm using the Everson language now because that is the most recent case, and I understand from Justice Bradley's questions that's going to be something we'll be talking about later. But with respect to the occurrence language, following Everson, do we have, even in a self-defense situation, an accidental occurrence that gets you beyond the coverage question to the intentional exclusion section of the policy?
If you approach it from the standpoint of what is the expectation of the insured, then it is an accident. The harm was not intended. The act was intended, but not the harm. And if you approach it in that fashion, then there certainly is is coverage. What is the motive, the subjective motive of that person, which has never been tried? The indemnification and the duty to defend is nuts. I'm parked in a place that's illegal for me to park because I'm not handicapped. The drunk loses control of his vehicle, crosses over the center line and hits me, and sues me because I was illegally parked. They do their investigation and evaluation, and they determine that I'll never lose the case. You try it 100 times, I'm never going to lose the case. So there's no duty to indemnify, so they don't have to defend me when I get sued because I'm going to win every time. And so if there is no indemnification, well, of course, any time there's an affirmative defense, any time that there is a privilege, you know, I'm going to get off. That doesn't eliminate their duty not to defend me. And in this particular instance, there's a question of fact. It's an occurrence that someone was saying, defend me on this. And so we can give example after example after example. Did they make this insurance bet that you would hurt somebody accidentally and I will defend you? And, you know, if we win, then you get off. If you lose, it's your problem, not mine. I'm the insurance company, and it's a battery, and that's an uncovered, you know, that's not covered by the policy. But we've got to get a chance to make that case. And under the Four Corners rule, we never get to make that case.
Your position is you want Berg to be alive.
Alive and well, and I think it should be the law of the land without question, that as the court said years ago, there are four, and then they're claiming it's dicta, but there are four recognized exceptions to the Four Corners rule. And that, you know, given that, you know, there should be exceptions to the Four Corners rule. The insured should be given the opportunity to get to the courthouse, have a trier of fact determine the fact as to whether or not the critical fact that determines coverage or no coverage, he's got a right to have either a judge or a jury make that finding of fact, and that finding of fact has never been made here, but it's been pled by the insurance company who's done their investigation, and they pled it on behalf of their insured and on behalf of their insurance company.
Counsel, your red light's on. Is there a question? Justice Prosser.
If you were writing the opinion, what would your paragraph describing the Four Corners rule at one, what would it be?
With regard to the Four Corners rule, the Four Corners rule preserves the integrity of the tort action by making them file, you know, they file an answer, and then there is a hearing that is, or there is some kind of a proceeding for declaratory judgment. If there is a question of fact, there will be a trial. And once that fact is determined, then as a matter of law, the judge will determine whether or not that is a covered peril.
There will be a lot of these.
Pardon?
There will be a lot of these little trials.
The one you see most often, Your Honor, is the one where there's no deep pocket. And the plaintiff who has been battered alleges that he was negligently battered. That's the case we see most often. And then they put in an answer saying, you know, and then there's another proceeding, there are two sets of lawyers, and there's a hearing, and there's a trial, and there's a determination of whether he was negligently battered or not. Usually the abuse is on the part of a claimant who's got an injury and he hasn't got a deep pocket for that bar fight. And so they get their day in court, but the insured doesn't. And so that's what makes it unfair. The Four Corners rule, all it does is give, if there is something that will bring it under coverage, the person who is being sued, the insured, has to have a forum where they can plead their case. They just can't just say it is controlled by the guy he beat up. I mean, the person who won the fight. I mean, they can't control. The person who hates me can't control the contract between myself and my insurance company. I've got to be able to plead my side of the case just as the insurance company has the right to plead their side of the case, have a trial on it, and have a determination.
Thank you, counsel. On behalf of the court, I want to thank Mr. O'Connor and Mr. Booth for their arguments today on yet another insurance case, of which we have numerous. That ends the hearing on 06-AP-939, Estate of Sustesh versus American Family Mutual Insurance Company. The court is adjourned for its February sittings. It sits again in March, an oral argument. We are adjourned. The court will meet at 3:15 in closed conference.